since I've been in North Carolina.
Oh, wow.
Mm-mm. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to California during Thanksgiving for a conference. And probably that's the first time I'll see the ocean. See, I have to go to California to see the ocean because I haven't. My husband tried to drive there one day, and I think he went the opposite direction. We kept driving and driving and driving. He was looking at the map. He doesn't know how to read maps. And after like 2.5 hours, so if you're not near it now, you're not going to be near it. And then he stopped someplace, and they go, no, the ocean's like way over there. I said, oh, forget it.
My grandmother passed away a few months ago, and for some reason, ever since that happened, I've just, like, wanted to get to the ocean.
Yeah.
I just felt like I really needed to, and this is the first time I was able to, so it was really awesome. I just, I don't know. It's a good place for that kind of stuff.
It is.
Well, are we recording?
We are.
All right. Cool. Well, we have some questions.
Okay.
But it can kind of go in whatever direction that needs to go. So maybe if you want to just start by telling us a little about Mass and your work here.
Well, Mass is the Muslim American Society, and it is consists of outreach, which basically outreach deals with the humanitarian services. Like we recently concluded our meat drive where we passed out meat to underprivileged people. Basically, we did something different. We didn't want to take it to like a second harvest. Even though we contributed there, we want to take it directly to the people. So we went to some of the more tested areas of Raleigh, and we people lined up for meat and for canned food goods and things like that. And we had Build a Backpack program, and what we do is order all these backpacks and put crayons, pencils, you know, and teachers give the kids those lists before school starts, even though it's public free education. To fill that backpack cost approximately $75 each. So we decided to build backpacks, and the mass outreach all across the United States, we typically do the same program, and then we went and we delivered the backpacks to certain schools where we knew that there are a lot of minority children and children who are in difficult situations. Now, I help out with outreach, but basically my job is with Freedom Foundation. And some of the things that I've dealt with in the year is with the Attorney General's office. Muslim women were systematically asked to either pull their scarves back or to have a third party come in and sign that they're wearing this for religious reasons, as if it's not obvious. And then she couldn't even sign her own affidavit. She had to have someone else to come in with her. So basically, if she didn't bring someone with her, she was not allowed to get her driver's license. So after discussing the matter several times with the Attorney General's office, they changed the policy. And because I said, if you can do that, then someone with wigs, they have to drag it back, you know. And it was, the Sikhs also appreciated the effort and other people that wear religious headdresses. They did change the policy, and now it's state law in North Carolina that they can't do that, and that just her face can be shown. And she doesn't have to have a third-party witness for her, that it's a matter of religion.
Congratulations.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Then the other thing is, even though, according to the Constitution, you have the right to pray, some of the schools were not open to allowing the children to involve in any spiritual practices during lunch. And we thought that they should be accommodated, whether they're Muslim, whether they're Jews, whether they're Christians, whether they're transcendental meditators. If they want to do this and it's their free time, why shouldn't they be allowed to do it? I think this society has gone way too far away from spiritual reflection, and our children and the society are suffering because of it. If they have no spiritual basis, it's hard to develop a humanitarian basis. And schools should actually be encouraging this behavior. It makes it more functional for the students to get along and for the teachers to be able to go about their job as teaching instead of spending part of their time policing students. They weren't trained to police students. They were put there to teach. But it's the biased education system that allows for us to try to cover spiritual issues and social and humanitarian development in the spirits of children. And I think that's a major problem in this country. And we need to be able to cultivate those relationships that while they're still innocent, so that when they grow up, they won't have to go through some of the trials and tribulation that Americans are still going through, even though I think that to a large extent they refuse to recognize the situations that they thought had dissolved in the 60s and 70s are really still here. I don't think they completely went away. And if you don't destroy something at the roots, it can grow again. And what else is Freedom Foundation doing? We're also trying to, at the same time, nurture foreign-born Muslims to become involved in activism in the United States. If you want to be part of the melting pot, you have to be inside of it and not on the perimeter, not be on the outside looking in. If you want to define yourself, then you have to be part of those who are creating the definition. 9/11 taught Muslims, if nothing more, that they had failed to establish who they are and what they really believed. So the majority of American people depended on the definition given by people like Osama bin Laden or the religious right who don't understand Muslims or who feel that there's something inherently evil about Islam. But you cannot really blame them for that if you're not speaking out on your own behalf.
So does that feel like the tug and pull in terms of how one gets to define oneself as a Muslim in the society? Like either mm-hmm. people see you in terms of what the right wing
mm-hmm.
is mm-hmm. viewing you, the fundamental right wing or the
mm-hmm.
fundamental the Islamist
mm-hmm.
Islamic fundamentalist.
As soon as anyone hears the term Islamicist, they become intimidated, bothered. Well, if you look at what an Islamicist is, it's a person. Islam means peace, and basically the majority of Muslims are peaceful people that are trying to coexist in this society. But when you look at things through a narrow view instead of a broader one, you're going to come up with very biased definitions and conclusions made by people who don't really know Muslims at all, and really they don't understand Islam. So our job is to educate Americans by showing them not just who we are with words, but by our action. And that means that we have to be activists. We have to involve ourselves in dialogue. We have to communicate to people what Islam really is. And Islam never said, according to the Quran and the practice of the Prophet, Muslims were never allowed to sideline themselves, but to go amongst the people. And not an attempt to convert the people, but to educate the people about our value system. And our value system is basic, does not really go against the value systems of Christians, religious Christians and religious Jews, or just spiritual people. We believe that you should treat others like you would want to be treated yourself. Mm-hmm. If you're not doing that, then you put yourself in a very hypocritical zone. Every man deserves respect and be judged on the basis of his character. It doesn't matter whether he's Muslim or not. You judge a person on his character. You relate to him on that basis. And we were remiss. We were kind of in a hibernation mode in the masjids or in the mosque. And that was wrong.
After September 11th?
Mm-hmm. Before September 11th. Okay. Now, Mass, Muslim American Society, started before September 11th. But with September 11th simply created a bigger urgency to advance our cause,
mm.
to spread to more states, to affect more Islamic centers, to enter into a dialogue with more Islamic organization, to recruit people to participate in activist programs or humanitarian programs like NAACP, like justice organizations, ACLU, groups like Stop Torture, Black Workers for Justice, to involve ourselves with the problems in the educational system here in North Carolina. You still see, what, 54 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, why are those children in Hope County not getting the same financial backing as the children up in Preston?
Hmm.
Because their parents don't live in the same kind of houses? That's not fair. All of us have a right to equal access to education. And Hope County has been, they've been trying this case for how many years? Most of the kids that are initially connected to that case, they're all grown back. Growing up, you can't give them back their childhood. You cannot supply them with everything that has been taken away from them. Yet, when they grow up in an adverse situation and they react to it, we're quick to punish them. We'd rather spend funds at that end of the spectrum instead of give them what they had a natural right to have from the very beginning. And so my job is to educate Muslims to involve themselves into social situations that are just not going to uplift Muslims, but uplift the society. Regardless of those children in Hope County are all of our children. And all of us, they have a right on all of us as Americans, as adults, as human beings to fight on their behalf. But at the same time, people just don't become activists overnight.
Mm.
There has to be a nurturing process, especially if they come from societies where they have been taught not to say anything, not to address the dictator, not to involve themselves in the political system. I mean, in many countries like Kuwait and Saudi Arabia, I think recently Kuwait allowed some women to vote, but the majority of the women in some of the Middle Eastern countries do not have a vote. Yet they are the majority of people in these countries. You see, in Saudi Arabia, they're not able to even drive, so how are they going to affect policy? So when they come here, they have to be reprogrammed, so to speak, to speak out. Now, they can speak out better from here than they can speak from there sometimes, but in order to speak, you have to open up your mouth first.
So is that one of the biggest challenges you face?
Yes.
As a Muslim American organizer trying to...
to culturally deprogram, I would call it. Yeah, that's a major problem.
What are some of the other challenges?
In every religious group, like I said, we still... there were so many problems in America in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s that Americans didn't want to look back. Americans don't want to admit that we still have a problem with equality and justice with regards to race.
Mm.
You can convert to Islam, but to a large extent, in a foreign-dominated community, you're still on the outside looking in. You know, it's like everybody else is invited for dinner and you're only invited for tea. You feel that, you know? And sometimes, and it's across the United States. I've been all to so many mosques across the United States, and with very few exceptions, you'll see American converts on the side. And even though they've been through these social movements and situations, they don't know how to address religious rights. And so as a result, you'll find that many of the councils and those who develop the programs for the Islamic organizations are not Americans. So you can't give, you know, it's hard to give what you don't have. So at the same time, we have to work for the rights of people outside the community and try to establish rights for people in the community. And that includes the rights of women, too. Because you have women that come from situations where they have been completely oppressed, women who didn't even choose their spouses, you know? And they're not encouraged and they're not inclined to speak up on their behalf. And sometimes they will find themselves in appalling situations, but they won't say anything. So we're trying to introduce them to a society where it's okay to speak out against domestic abuse. It's okay to speak out if your children are living in fear from verbal abuse or being harmed. It's okay to speak out if your child's teacher at school is practicing some type of discrimination. You don't have to be silent anymore. And we'll help you. We'll speak with you. And what we're doing now is developing programs, a program which will help women to do that, which will teach them to be able to use a computer, apply for a job, skills that they'll be able to feel, that will make them feel empowered. Even if they don't use it, they'll feel empowered to do something for themselves. And also, in order not to destroy the family structure, you know, Brian Prophet is part of the group Men Against Domestic...
Men Against Rape Culture?
Yeah. And also, he was doing a program against domestic violence. And I wanted to align myself with him so he could bring in people who have experienced this sort of situation. He knows men who have actually been abusers that have turned their lives around and become able to help their families and not be destructive to the family itself. Mm-hmm. So the first thing is helping each person to identify their rights. As long as you don't recognize your rights, you subject yourself to being oppressed. Mm-hmm. But I do think in this society, there are so many things that Muslims are disconnected with, and I'm uncomfortable with that. I want them to become connected with the situations, the difficult treatment that the Latinos have to live with every day working in this country. I want them to become familiarized that they're black children, that even that Martin Luther King's dream has not become fully realized, okay? His dream has only been, you know, how can you put it? I mean, we woke up from that dream way too soon that we didn't have a chance to complete it. I want them to realize that women are to be treated equal to men, and that Islam dictates that they are to be treated kindness in marriage, kindness in divorce, okay? You deal with them with kindness or you leave the situation. I want them to realize that other women need our help, and that if your neighbor is being abused, that you have a responsibility to speak up, mm-hmm. you know? Don't stand there and listen to the screams. No one should have to... You know, if you're a neighbor, if you're part of the culture of humanity, you're going to report that a crime is being done. I want them just to speak, to voice, you know. I want them to participate in the electoral process, you know. Maybe you're not going to get everything that you're asking for, but if you don't even ask, then the guaranteed you're not going to get anything. And I want to introduce the two cultures, different cultures, where they learn to cohabitate together in an environment of peace, love, and true affection. Not the artificial kind, but real affection. And that's not just between Muslim and Muslim, but Muslim and Christian, and Muslim and Hindu, and Muslim and Jew. Obviously, we should be able to see now that we're in this boat together. Mm-hmm. If we don't fight the struggles of the day together, then we're all going to sink. Mm-hmm. Change can only come by the masses of the people coordinating their efforts to change the system. And we can do that. We certainly have the numbers. Why would we, all these millions and millions of people, allow our country to do things that are against our better judgment, our sense of justice, mm-hmm. and our need for peace? Why would we subject our children to suffer because they're willing to spend billions of dollars on weapons instead of feed kids? Why would we allow our children to go without health care so that we use money to bury dead soldiers?
Yeah.
And why would we elect people to do that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there moments when you've been surprised by how much your fellow Muslims in North Carolina have risen to the occasion on issues like that? Like moments where you've been like, wow, we're really mm-hmm. together on this.
Yeah, I at first when the outreach made it, the national outreach made it very clear that our goal was just not to provide outreach services for Muslims, but non-Muslims, I wondered how that would go over with the Muslim communities. But it's gone over very well. I mean, we get so many donations, you know, and we try to make videos. And if they're not going to come out and see that side of life, then we've got to take the information to them, because any of us could be in that situation, but by the grace of God. So they have been outstanding in their contributions, and the programs have become very successful in Iowa. They've established the Iowa Humanitarian Corps has coordinated their efforts with another organization to provide health care. Very, very low monetary health care. They get good services, but at a fraction of the cost. And they're opening up clinics where people that cannot afford anything can go in there. I think that one is in, yeah, it's in Iowa too, where someone can go in and get shots for their children, get treated for infections and colds, and they don't have to pay anything. And a lot of non-Muslims are utilizing the services. And this is a good thing, because nothing can progress without true interaction. If we don't interact, I don't know who you are, you don't know who I am, and we become distant. Our distance is permanent. So this is, the outreach program has been very good. Freedom Foundation works well because we're out there with everybody. You know what I mean? Just like, how did I meet you guys? It was through the quest for civil rights and for equal opportunity and for livable wage and for justice. We've all got to take that stand together. And because of our common interests and our dialogue, we've become friends, we know each other, and we know that we can trust each other. You know, when I was stuck in Lebanon, I read that you sent out the email asking for help on my behalf, and I want to thank you for that now. But that's what happens when you get to know people. You develop relationships that you would have never, ever benefit or had access to if you hadn't made that connection. So it's about making a connection.
Mm-hmm. Do you want us to put in pause? Do you need to address this person?
Okay. No. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you got involved, like what your path to activism was and what your path to Islam was?
Well, I became Muslim in high school, so in a way I was just searching, and I met some Muslims in the mall, and they convinced me to come to the masjid, and I felt very comfortable with the ideology, and I converted. And I, through the process of converting and after my conversion, I came into contact with really, really good, knowledgeable Muslims. At that time, there were a lot of Muslim students just coming here to be educated, and eventually they would return home. But they were activists in their own right. They came from diverse backgrounds. They came from oppressed governments, but these were the kind of people that spoke out. I began to learn about the situation of the occupied territories, and it kind of nurtured a sense of wanting to do something to create change. And then I was able to go to Afghanistan and work in a refugee camp. During that time, after I came back, I went to UCLA and I studied paralegal services, and paralegal studies, and through paralegals I came into contact with many immigrants, and it is very difficult to remain disconnected from what they suffer in the society and their fears about being forced out of the society when they know if they go home that there's nothing there for them. So I think it's been kind of a nurturing, you know. And there was a time where I kind of like gave up, oh well, you know, nothing's changing, what's going to happen? But then if you give up, then the other side wins. And coming to North Carolina, I was surprised when I came to North Carolina, saw so much activism. No one in California would believe it. The only thing I knew about the South was that movie Mississippi Burning, and I was sure I was going to be driving down a dark street at night and somebody was going to shoot at me. But I was shocked when I came here and saw all the groups, you know, and the collective activities and things that they were standing up for, and it was amazing. And I said, shame on me, you know, it's time to get more involved. And then I met the head of outreach here, his name is Iyad Hindi, and he said, what can you do? And he really encouraged me to get active. He talked to me about mass ideology. He talked to me about the need to push ourselves to interact into society and become a part of it. You know, not sitting back taking anything for granted. And he spends most of his working hours doing just that. And then when Freedom Foundation wanted to open up the office here, he had thought that I could do it. I wanted the challenge, and that's how I began here. And it's been really, really rewarding. I've met really good people. I've been able to go to Palestine and visit the occupied territories and see their situation. In fact, when I went, I was with Martin Luther King III, and he was talking about realizing the dream, and we met with Israelis and with Palestinians and heard the different stories and saw the situation there. And then there were congressmen with us who also changed their minds about the situation there and realized that the aid that the United States was giving to Israel was really harming the Palestinian. Mm. And with then with Jimmy Carter's book, it really opened up the subject matter a lot. So we're working not just on the political scenario here, but how it affects those in the Middle East too. And I think what it does, it gives the Muslims here more confidence that they can be Americans and still keep their religious beliefs and integrity and still be considered about the needs of their families in the Middle East. And that it doesn't mean they're not patriotic. It just means that they want a clear, accurate picture of what's going on in a situation where America is propagating justice instead of apartheid. So, little by little, I think I'm still in the process of growing and developing in this job. And I know that I have a long way to go, but there's so many things that I'd like to see happen. The different programs. Like to get more Muslims involved locally in local politics as far as the school board is. Because like I said in the beginning, I do think that our children need to be more spiritually in tune to themselves, you know. And to nurture the innocence that they're naturally born with, to cooperate with each other, to be kind with each other, to recognize each other's differences. And if we can do this and we really have achieved and given respect to that, those concept, multiculturalism and melting pot. If not, if we burn our children out, if we teach them hostility instead of peace, then we've defeated and we've set up another generation for war. And I don't think that's what we want to do.
Mm-hmm. In terms of not setting up another generation for war, mm-hmm. I know that you have an amazing track record of bringing things to the masjid that people are not used to seeing in masjids, mm-hmm. like the counter-recruitment panel where you invited mm-hmm. a group mm-hmm. of us to come, mm-hmm. young people who had just attended this Not Your Soldier camp.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other things in that vein that have proved successful?
Yeah.
In terms of organizing within the masjid? I mean, we're hoping that folks will be reading this across the country and they'll be getting good ideas about stuff they can do.
Well, it used to be, I mean, there's a term now, Islamic phobia, but there, amongst Muslims, there was this thing called Jewish phobia. And what we're doing now is, you know, you're going to find people with common values regardless of what their religious backgrounds are and people that stand for justice. So now we want to bring Jews to the masjid. We want to... And I want to take it further. Just don't invite them to the masjid. Invite them to your home.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sit down and break bread and drink a cup of tea. Interact, become friends, you know. And we had an interfaith. And from bringing different people to the masjid, different groups, different religious groups, different political backgrounds, we had an interfaith camp in Greensboro. And we stayed the weekend together and we talked about different issues. We've had lots of ACLU presentations against racial profiling, and now we're embarking on, you know, the Taser Project. We've had, We've had we haven't had that yet. We're inviting Rachel Corey's family to come to the. We have an office actually in Charlotte too. Huge center there. We want her parents to come there and to give a talk, so that there's that human exchange. Mm-hmm. You know, she was there fighting on behalf of people that she didn't have to be there. She made a choice to fight for freedom, and she lost her life in doing so. And I think that it would be cruel to not recognize her sacrifice and not recognize the sacrifice of her family. So I think this type of interaction will be productive. We'll show, we're showing films like Occupation 101, and we're actually going to be planning a spring concert, a Canadian group that's singing like Palestinians about songs about occupation. So mm-hmm. we're planning on lots of programs. November 10th, we're having Exercise Your Voice. It's like a town hall meeting. And we've invited Keith Ellison. He's the first Muslim congressman from Virginia. We're invited Walter Fauntroy. He co-authored the Civil Rights Bill. We've Jamil Johnson, Congressional Chief of Staff, November 10th at Cary Senior Center. They'll all be there, and a host of others. And they've come there to teach, to advocate to Muslim population and to vote. You know, sometimes it's not who you're voting for, but what you're voting against. You know, it's not, if we had voted for the lesser of the evils, we wouldn't have George Bush as our president today. Now, I'm not saying there's anything evil about, I can't even remember his name now. John Kerry. But he didn't have the confidence of the people, because his voice to the people was sort of limited. Mm-hmm. His wife actually had a stronger voice than him. To me, she was much more impressionable. I would have voted for her in a minute. But she knew how to stand her ground. Mm-hmm. He was too wishy-washy, so people end up voting for George Bush, I think. We'll never really know. But we want them to participate, you know, do something. I mean, maybe it's going to happen that the masses of the people are going to have to create a third party, you know, based on ethics and their conscience. And we have the ability to put a third party into the White House. I think that people think that they have to vote either or, and that's how come Ralph Nader has really never had his chance to do what he wants to do. At the same time, we damage our own chances of survival. You know, global warming has to be important to everybody. The environment is significant to every living thing and every living human being. So we want to teach them that politics goes beyond one man or one political party. Mm-hmm. It becomes the people's voice. And it's the least thing you can do. It takes you about 10 minutes. You know, maybe you have to stand in line for about 5 or 10 minutes, but you get up there, you do your thing, and you go home. At least you've done something.
Mm. But doing nothing. What's the teaser mm-hmm. project coming up?
Well, the ACLU, they've done a statistical. What they're doing is gathering statistics, actually, on who tasers are being used on, and it looks as if that people that are being tasered are poor and minorities. Mm-hmm. You're not going to catch too many people being tasered in Beverly Hills or in the really popular areas of New York City. But if you go to the minority areas in different states, who's getting tasered? Mm-hmm. And I was shocked that recently there was an incident where a pregnant woman, she was just trying to get up, and the officer kept using his taser gun to make her get down. But I think she was trying to turn to protect the baby. Now, from what I understand, the baby wasn't injured, but it's becoming a common use. kind of a, I guess, the weapon of choice, but those tasers can do a lot of damage. And the extent of the damage is not known. And if it's being selective, if they're using taser guns in selected areas, then the people need to be made aware of that fact and need to act on it. And if more, and as far as the racial profiling, if more people are getting stopped because of their ethnicity, is something that we need to deal with. So, especially in North Carolina, now that most of the sheriff departments are now deputized as ICE, you know, Homeland Security agents, and they can literally stop someone for going through a stop sign, and next thing they know, they're locked up, being forced to sign voluntary deportation orders. And that's not right. I mean, with no counsel, no family notification where they are or how long they're going to be there. There's still something called the Constitution, and it goes beyond being a piece of paper. It's being used and abused by the administration. But the people have got to stand up and say, we insist on having our constitutional rights, and one man doesn't have the right to take it away. He doesn't have the right to elect the Supreme Court that's going to help him to do that. The Supreme Court have become the puppets of George Bush. He holds them on a string. And they're not a decisive factor of in American rights, just they're allowing the abuse to continue, whether it's here or Guantanamo Bay. So I think we're at a crossroads here, but the only way to get beyond it constructively is for all of us to put our resources together and stage a mass movement that guarantees our rights, mm-hmm. our rights as human beings and as citizens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little, with all the different work that you're doing, it sounds like you're mm-hmm. really busy with all of it, mm-hmm. how do you stay grounded and stay centered and make it sustainable and try to stay healthy, and how's mm-hmm. your faith and spirituality kind of play into that or not play into that? What do you do?
Well, I think I learned a long time ago that you have to depend on a higher power giving you that spiritual rejuvenation. If you depend on people, you might get left down. You have to look at the cause instead of the people participating in the cause. I have to judge Islam by the book, by the Quran, instead of by the behavior of people, because if you do that, you subject yourself to being let down. Mm. Like, for example, when Osama bin Laden surfaced again, I knew that would start create a problem for Muslims. You know, we wanted him to just disappear. You know, because his role is to divide Muslims from other people and to label people as enemies, and we're fighting against that. That goes against all of our work. So sometimes that can be disheartening, and especially when you go outside in the scarf and people will say things, or people will spit, or people will holler or something like that, you say, oh wow, I'm going to move. But then you say, it's easy to walk away, but if we all walk away, there's nobody left to take a stand. And so what I do is try to just go home, get over my anger and my grief, and then we go back to the job of doing what we have to do. And we are constantly in pursuit of people, recruiting people to work in Freedom Foundation. We tell them from the get-go that we're all in this together, mm-hmm. that if you're about staying, if you're about hiding in the closet, then Freedom Foundation isn't for you. You have to step out. You have to put yourself with the people and in place of the people. Look mm-hmm. at yourself, look at your, you know, where you're going. You want to help them transcend where they're at and go in the direction that you want to be going in. And this means a decent, hospitable environment for everybody. And we don't want them to be inhibited by their scarves. You know, there are people that have suffered much worse than us, and we're all obligated to help out. So you just have to put yourself back on task, get over it, and keep on going.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any, can you talk a little bit about your kind of daily religious and spiritual practices, mm-hmm. and then how you might use those to kind of like find that mm-hmm. that strength to keep going?
About 4 years ago, a friend of mine gave my daughter a little book. It's a little book with little supplications in it. And if you see this book, it's real raggedy now and dirty around the edges because I just keep reading it. And then sometimes I just, you know, prior to Islam, I started transcendental meditation. So I just, in the past few months, I've gone back to just meditating, just quietly meditating, reminding myself, saying spiritual words, reciting the Quran, reminding myself of all the good people that I've come into contact with, and seeing that there isn't just hardship in this work, but there's joy too, because you really meet people that you would have never expected to meet, and you hear ideas you would have never expected would come from the mouths of people that think just like you, that are just like you and want the same goals. And that's always the kind of rejuvenation. Mm. It's a rejuvenation when you go to a rally and you see soldiers come up who are opposed to the war and want peace. It's a rejuvenation when you see those old grandmothers. Now, if they can get out of their beds with their arthritis and come and march for freedom, then none of us have an excuse.
That's right.
And you see the soldiers that have been crippled, you know, and that are blind, and you know that if you don't say something, there'll be more people that will have to suffer. And the government is never going to give them the recognition or the recovery that they deserve. Look at the Vietnam veterans. So that's an incentive. And also the National in Washington, D.C., every day I get like a support call, you know. So what do you plan today and how can we help you? And these are the issues that we need to look at. And we have meetings, and we have structure meetings. We'll be meeting in the first week in November just to develop projects and ideas. And actually, most of the Freedom Foundation directors across the United States are women, and that helps. they're mostly women. Mm-hmm. So mass, I think the one thing I can say about Muslim American society is revolutionary when it comes to putting women in executive positions. In chapters all across America, you see women on the leadership councils. You see women as directors. You see women working the legal clinics. And the legal clinics is another project that's going to be expanded throughout all the Freedom Foundations across America. You see women lecturers at the annual conferences. So it's gone beyond the spiritual or the mosque norms. Okay, they have. In fact, the head of Muslim American Society, his name is Suhail Ghanoushi. He tells the men not only should you support your wives, but you need to be in the kitchen helping to make the dinner for the children. Mm. You need to be able to allow her the ability to do what she has to do. And he actively recruits and puts women in these positions and gives them the support and the motivation and the training to do the tasks that need to be done in America. So it's working out really good. We have good support. Mm. Really good support.
Mm. Did you want to ask a question, Lex? I feel like you and Isabel are taking
questions. I'm just taking notes and taking notes. And taking notes. These are really good questions and really inspiring responses.
Yeah.
And I was going to ask you earlier, Khalila, you said something about Islamophobia. Do you feel like Islamophobia is an issue within progressive organizations outside of the Muslim community? If you had any issues within progressive organizations and people not understanding or acting in ways that kind of mirror the larger society's issues?
In North Carolina, maybe one. But I think the majority of the organizations are more open-minded than that, and they're motivated toward cultivating good, solid relationship with Muslims. They would like to see more Muslims attend. They welcome their contributions to the organizations. There's like North Carolina Peace and Justice, Coalition for Peace and Justice, different organizations, Tikkun. I think that they welcome Muslims. I think that they still have a lot to learn about Muslim ideology and the thought processes and about the religious customs, but I think that there is a genuine they're willing to give it a good go, that their sincerity is authentic. I think sometimes because as Americans we are sensitive toward those soldiers that go to war, that there's a tendency with some organizations to ignore the other victims of the war, like in the situation with the Iraqis. I don't think that Americans would be so conditioned to they develop an emotional immunity to what's going on with the people, with regards to the rapes, with regards to what looks like murder. I mean, people just shot in the head. How is it people or a group of people can be lined up and shot in the head? I don't think that it's happening necessarily from Iraqis that are fighting other Iraqis. There's certainly enough evidence that have been shown that there are soldiers that are participating in these murders, and they come here and they get light sentence, which creates hostilities in the Middle East. And people want payback. And I think that the government has addressed this issue. But what was the question exactly?
Well, you're definitely getting at it. Just it sounds like what you're saying, that in some of the anti-war organizing people
they're
are
not,
so focused
they're
on
ignoring
supporting
these
the
points.
Soldiers.
Right. And like Aguirre prison, they show the pictures of the crimes against the men, but Congressman Price told us that there were pictures about women being sexually abused. Mm-hmm. Those pictures weren't shown. And I'm a little bit intolerant, as we were discussing earlier, about rape being used as a tool of war.
Mm-hmm.
Never, this issue has never been properly addressed, whether it's in Darfur, whether it's in Iraq, even though it was in Bosnia. In every war, women are commonly used to punish the competitor, you know. Women, the soldiers rape the wives of whoever they're fighting against. And at the end of the war, people are brought up on war crimes, but never for the rapes of women or for the mutilation of children. Now, I think that it just shows basic sexism. Why wouldn't you acknowledge, why wouldn't you make someone accountable for crimes so horrible? When 3, 4, and 5-year-olds are being raped by grown men, this is pathological. Why would you ignore something like that? How do you think these people will grow up to live? How do you think they will psychologically survive that type of torment? Yet the governments, all of them, systematically ignore it. So they want to brush it underneath the carpet. Well, the war is over, so we don't want to deal with that issue. But those women and children will have to deal with those issues for the rest of their lives. And there was no healing for the women of Bosnia. So many of those women actually had to gave birth, because abortion is typically forbidden in Islam. They gave birth to the babies of their enemies. Of course, they kept these children and they loved these children, but at the same time, they would be forever stained in their society for having the baby of a Serb. It will affect her entire life, because chances are she will never be able to be married. Mm-hmm. Same thing with Darfur. Even though the women have nothing to do with the crime of rape, nothing to do with their victimization, they will be forever stained, because they will be considered, they will be a constant reminder of having been with the enemy or having been used by the enemy. And I think that there comes a time someone has to pay for these crimes. Now, I know the Sudanese government has aided and abetted the genocide, but so has soldiers from Chad and the surrounding countries. All these men have come from these different tribes, these different countries, and they've created havoc in the lives of these women. They have raped them. There are children from documents of children from 3 to women 89 years old. Now, that's not a crime of, that's not sexual passion. That is a crime of violence, criminal, psychotic violence. Yet, nobody does anything. Unless we can get a movie star to come say, hey, this is wrong. That should not be a tool to raise the consciousness of the people. It's the act itself that should make the people scream stop. That this cannot continue. Mm-hmm. But if our president, our vice president, our leaders in Congress don't address this issue, then who will? Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to, a real women's movement with the support of men have to evolve, saying that this is a crime that can no longer go unnoticed. Mm-hmm. It's wrong.
Mm-hmm. I know I told you I'm studying women and gender studies now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we're talking about is how, like, the traditional women's movement in the United States, the mostly white women's movement, kind of, like, sees these issues as separate or sees them as obligated to go save people from other cultures or from other countries. Mm-hmm. Do you see any of that kind of playing out in movements here or ways that people address the issues specifically that affect Muslim women?
I think that it's a good thing to want to export your humanity, but I think that there's a lot that has to be done here with regards to the women's movement. When a woman can work for a company and she's not being paid the same as a man, there's something wrong. When a woman has to look a certain way and dress a certain way just to be employable, there's something wrong with the ideology of that company. When women are subject to all kinds of sexual abuse verbal abuse from management or from their managers, is something wrong, and that these issues have never been properly addressed in the court system, and women feel like that they have to cater to the people that hire them. They're not treated with the same dignity and respect as a man, and that's wrong. And we can't, I think, by focusing on other countries, we have a tendency to ignore the problems that exist in our country. You have the right to follow your path and to be able to achieve your dreams without compromising your body or the way that you think. And compromising your body doesn't mean being forced to sleep with someone, but have to dress a certain way, you know, or have to smell, to wear a certain kind of a perfume when you go to work, or to wear a certain kind of heels, or to look sexy. You have to be accepted based on your ability to perform in the job for which you were hired, not to appease the sensitivities of men. So I think that these situations have to be addressed, and it has to be addressed beyond Oprah. I mean, in corporations across the United States, women are being psychologically beaten up. And to show you the difference in how this country, and men in particular, perceive women, look at the difference that Martha Stewart was treated compared to the guy from Enron. Okay? She was dragged through the mud, but basically, being a friend of George Bush, he was given every type of exemption and privilege until finally he was convicted and then he died. Never had to suffer for anything. Mm. And I think that that was a detour not to look at all the white-collar crime that's actually being committed, the abuses, that the economic abuses in company that was actually being committed by men at that time. Women are, it's very difficult for them to climb the corporate ladder. They have to still have to do double the job. They have to make a choice. Either you're going to do this. If you're going to do this, you can't have a family. If you have a family, then you can't do this. Women are afraid to take off too many days, even though their kids are sick, because they're going to get fired. Men never get fired for taking off to take care of the kids unless they happen to be a single parent. It's a fact that we have diminished the meaning of what family is, because we've lost that real pure sense of family values, that we demote what women contribute to the society and what women have to contribute to the family structure. Mm-hmm. That's not fair. Why should we be held to a different standard? Mm-hmm. They thought that they were doing something, some companies thought they were doing something revolutionary a while back when they would give a guy a month off when his wife had a baby. Oh, gee whiz, isn't that great? He wasn't up there breastfeeding that baby and staying up at night, you know? I mean, that's wonderful to assist him in the bonding, but the real bonding comes in that cooperative effort that it takes to raise a child when two parents are allowed the choice and the ability to take off from work and take care of a sick child, to nurture that child. But to make a woman to make a choice that she shouldn't have to make is ethically wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's wrong for a country that claims to be democratic. Mm-hmm. It's wrong for a country that says, well, we give women rights, and then at the same time, we're kind of like scraping away those rights one by one, her right to parent, her right to fulfill her economic dreams or her goals in life. Mm-hmm. She shouldn't have to make that choice. And men don't have to make a choice. She shouldn't have to either.
Sure.
Yeah. When men walk away from families, when a woman walks away from families, they charge her in court with, what is it called? We city all the time when she walks out. Child abuse, or not child abuse, when she, I forget what
neglect,
the law, child neglect or child abuse. But men walk away every day from their families and nobody says anything. In fact, it's hard to find them to even get child support. But if that child's not being fed properly, I mean, the hit's on her, it's not on him. Where is the father? She didn't make that baby by herself. She shouldn't be forced to take care of that baby by herself. And the fact, one time I was in court and the judge actually told the mother that the father was there. He cannot force the father to spend time with this child. But she's forced to spend time with that child. If she was to leave that child in the house alone, she would be arrested for abuse, okay, or for child neglect. Why is he allowed to walk away? Why is he allowed to walk anywhere in the United States and start over without ever being made accountable for the life of a child that he helped to create? These are the problems in society that have to be dealt with. If you want to divorce your wife, that's fine, but don't divorce your child. You have a responsibility to take care of that child. But until these things are enforced, or at least we can educate a man with the ethical ability to perceive his role in the family structure, then we're not going to succeed as a family. Mm-hmm. These kids out there, they're looking for something. They're looking for something to hold on to. Something they can trust, and they don't have it. And I think that's the problem.
Do you feel like the teachings of Islam offer that kind of ethical grounding?
Yeah, I think that the teachings of Islam are. Sometimes the cultures in which Islam is evolving don't put the same type of emphasis and the responsibility on both parents. But in Islam, it says that men are maintainers of women and children. And Islam is just not talking about economics. They're talking about parenting. They're talking about the education and welfare of that child. That means that a man can pick up a pot and make some rice and meat for a child and feed that child with his hands. It means that he can wipe a runny nose when that child has a cold. It means that he's obligated to sit and read a book with his daughter or his son. It means that he's not allowed to walk away. Because it's not even until the age of 18 that a man is supposed to be responsible for his children. Until his daughter leaves the house and marries, he is financially responsible for his daughter, and forever emotionally he is responsible for his child. He should always try to uplift and reinforce and to help his daughter with the emotional development throughout his lifetime. You never cease to be a father and a mother. But sometimes I think we limit the responsibility we place on parents. I think Islam encourages, certainly the book mandates it, the Quran mandates it, but, you know, every individual has to assume his responsibility for the words that are included in the Quran. And also, technically, the Muslims, we have three books, which is the Quran, the Bible, and the Torah. So we need to draw from all these sources. The spiritual guidance that's been put in all of these books, and to practice them to the best of our ability, and to voice our concern, and to look to the welfare of our children, and to our neighbor's children too, because at the end of the day, we all are our brother's keeper. So if you see someone next door to you, a child that looks, you know, lost or looks like they need your help, then it's your responsibility to reach out and help that child. We're trying to get Muslim parents involved in more foster care and the youth into boys' clubs. That we're trying to encourage our high school students now. We're working with, Rukaya?
Rukia?
A tutoring program, after-school tutoring program to help you know, kids that maybe, you know, their parents have to work. It's hard to work 10 hours a day to support a child and come home and have the wherewithal to help that child with their homework. Mm-hmm. If they can get someone to help them after school at a boys' club or even at this center, then we want to be able to do that, you know, to give some relief to that working mother, that working father that has to work 12 hours a day, maybe for only $7 or $8 an hour, mm-hmm. which isn't a livable wage. Mm-hmm. Very difficult to support a child and fulfill the needs of a child off of that kind of money. These issues affect us all. And the Quran says that we have to give help where it's needed, regardless of what someone's religious background is.
I guess I have one other mm-hmm. kind of question, or maybe a couple kind of related questions. Mm-hmm. If, in terms of working, it sounds like a lot of your work is in working within your community, but also with trying to build those coalitions. Mm-hmm. What do you wish that or non-Muslim organizations would do to support the work of Muslim organizing differently or better? Or
I wish that they would go to the mosque and get up close and personal and say, why aren't you here helping us? Why have you chosen to sideline yourself when you're a part of this country? I don't think that we should allow Muslims or anyone else to be in denial about what his role, what his or her role is in the society. If the Muslims don't come to them, then they should come and say, what are you going to do? You know, you can't be in it and not of it. What are you going to do about the conditions of the poor? What are you going to do about the people that have to bring those barbecue pits into their house just to warm up in the winter? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about a president that wants to destroy the reasons that you came here? Mm-hmm. I think that, and I like for them to get to know what authentic Islam is, instead of the artificial Islam created by extremists who really, I think, are looking for their own interests and their own, I don't know what causes them to do the things that they do or harm the people that they hurt. But I want them to turn a deaf ear to these people. I mean, listen to them as far in matters of security and for self-protection, but listen to the mainstream Muslims and to their voice, and they're going to see that their voice isn't much different. We may pray five times a day, but, you know, we look at television, we like to have fun, we go to the movie theater, some of us listen to music, some of us, you know, we like to go to a picnic and a barbecue and do just you know, like to have fun just like everybody else, ordinary people. Don't let the scar fool you into creating an idea of us, an idea of Muslims that doesn't really exist. And don't judge us by the behavior of countries or of cultural values that come from places like Saudi Arabia. We're just ordinary people.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
This has been an interview with Alexis, Manju, and Isabel with Khalila Sabra at the MAS office. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for giving us so much time, Khalila.
Oh,